Welcome to Whitley on Wine with your host, nationally syndicated wine columnist Robert Whitley.
Peel me a grape, crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow. Talk to me nice, talk to me nice, you've got to wine me. Don't try to fool me, bejewel me, either amuse me or lose me. I'm getting hungry, peel me a grape.
Another week of Whitley on Wine. Thank you for joining me. My guest today is my good friend Adam Lazar, who for many, many years now has been making the great value wines at Hahn Estates and Smith & Hook Winery. And when I say value wines, these aren't cheap wines, but they're wines that I would describe as wines that over-deliver. So if you pay $20, you're getting a wine that tastes more like a $40 wine. And if you spend $14, you're getting a wine that tastes like $30. Adam, welcome, and would you say that's a fair assessment of the Hahn wines?
You know, that has always been the goal is, you know, rule number one is to over-deliver and make a wine that tastes twice the price, yeah.
So, you know, we've had you on before. We've talked about Hahn, but you have a new venture, which I'm having trouble getting my head around because, you know...
I'm actually looking at the website as I speak to you right now. It's the first time I've actually been on.
I've known you through many incarnations. You know, you've worked at a lot of wineries.
Sure.
But you've been at Hahn, what, 7, 8 years now? 10?
Yeah, just about 8 years.
Yeah, something like that. And you're kind of pulling back a little bit from Hahn, and you've taken on a new project called Villa San Juliet Winery.
That is correct.
Now, there's nothing really unusual about a winemaker, you know, changing jobs or branching out or doing some consulting work or that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But there seems to be a really interesting story behind Villa San Juliet. And I was assuming, because the people who own this do reality shows, that mm-hmm. they were going to not only hire you as the winemaker, but make you a TV star.
They haven't seen me on TV yet. Probably. We'll just put it like this. I'm going to keep my day job.
Well, you could take your sunglasses off.
I did, believe it or not.
So,
you know, I absolutely adore Nicky Hahn and Bill Egan and the people up at Hahn Estates. It's been wonderful. I had a great a deal of opportunity to craft great wines and transition the vineyards over to Pinot Noir and all the fun stuff. But I've got a guy by the name of Paul Clifton. I know you've met.
Yeah, I know Paul.
Who's just a fantastic young winemaker. He lives up there in the area, and he's just such a master of the Burgundian varietals, which is really a main focus of Hahn now. And my commute, I've been living in Paso Robles for about 6.5 years now, which is, it's a 190-mile commute. And after 6.5 years, it just I love Paso. I love the fabric of Paso and everything that I have.
Now, 190-mile commute, you mean a week?
190 miles a day.
A day?
A day.
To go up to Hahn? Up in kind of central Monterey County?
Yeah, it's probably nothing for, you know, any of your listeners out in the, you know, San Francisco Bay Area. But for me, that's just a long haul on Highway 101.
Oh, sure.
And, where I live is near Meridian Winery down in Paso Robles, and it's about 89 miles.
You don't have to answer this, but I know that stretch of road. How many speeding tickets have you gotten?
none, and B, it's predicated upon the very nice passport radar detector that I purchased.
Well, you know, right there in King City, as you're heading north, you go right through the, you know, that's where the CHP is headquartered.
And our Monterey International Wine Competition. We're quite familiar.
Yeah, I always know where to slow down.
Yeah. But, I've lived here for 6.5 years, and, I get up in the morning when it's still dark. I head up to the winery. I get home when it's dark, and I've never really felt like I was a part of Paso Robles. My fiance Angie lives down here, and I was doing a lot of traveling for Hahn. You know, every time we talked, I was in some airport somewhere, and decided, you know, these guys, I got a phone call out of the blue. They said, would you be interested in meeting Ken Warwick and Nigel Lithgow, and you know, they're going to be flying up to the, I'm flying, okay, up to Paso Robles, and sure enough, the next day they dropped a helicopter into their parking lot of the new winery and got out and said, you know, we love your wines. Would you be interested in joining us? I said, okay. So, but I do still consult with Han part-time. Nikki Han is still helping me pay my mortgage, and I still want to be a part of that team, at least until the position with Villa San Juliet.
Well, you did a lot of great things there, and just to recap it a little bit, and then we'll talk a little more about this new venture. But I mean, you did remarkable things with the Red Meritage wine. You won many sweepstakes awards at wine competitions. And when I say sweepstakes, I'm talking about best of show red wine or whatever with that wine. You did very well with the Syrah. I remember one year in Monterey, you had the Merlot that won Best of Show red wine. You were very adept, it seemed like, with the Bordeaux varietals and Syrah, and Pinot Noir was a relatively recent thing. I don't know that you've captured any of the big prizes with that wine, but just over the years, we've seen these Han wines go from, a position of being relatively unknown and therefore, you know, not as appreciated as they could have been.
A delicate way of putting it.
Yeah. to winning big prizes everywhere and becoming very well known for the value that they provided, because these wines always gave you a little bit more than what you thought you would get based on the price. I remember the Merlot that won at Monterey was $14 a bottle.
You know, I've been blessed by having apparently the best vineyard manager on the planet, Andy Mitchell, who's really, you know, the winemaker behind all of this. And you can't, as you know, you can't really let the winemakers tell you that they're the superstars of the facility. Mm-hmm. It's really the guys who spend 11 months making the wine out in the vineyards.
But you did a good job with what he brought to you. And, you deserve credit for that.
Well, thank you. It was a great team. And again, Nicky Han, you know, he owns everything outright, so he doesn't have a mortgage to pass on it. And it's always been his commitment to, you know, he can live. This isn't his only job. He can live with a smaller margin than a lot of other wineries do.
So at Villa San Juliet.
Yes.
Okay. It's in Paso Robles, right?
It is in Paso Robles.
It's in Paso. What are the grape varieties? How long have the vines been planted? I see here that they've got this reality show called Corkscrewed. are we gonna see you in the TV show? And what can we expect from these wines? Or is this just sort of a, you know, Hollywood production?
No. And you know what? That's a great super question to ask, because as you know, you taste more wines in a week than all of us do an entire year. That's your job. And one of the things, as I mentioned to Ken and Nigel, is that, you know, you've got this kind of an albatross around your neck. Most celebrity wines are really not very good. People lend their name to them. They're made elsewhere. They're not involved. These guys are intimately involved in every aspect. They pour over every permit. They, you know, they're involved in the selection of what glass company we use for the bottles.
Mm-hmm.
Based on their involvement, I'm convinced that they're going to provide all the resources to do great things. We have a 120-acre vineyard that they purchased.
Where is it? East side, west side?
It's east side, northeast side. It's out in a region called Cross Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
By near Castoro, near Silver Horse,
mm-hmm.
in that neighborhood, they purchased the vineyard. It had actually been an established vineyard, and I believe the television show, I didn't see the show, it was a couple of years ago, but it was eaten up pretty badly by phylloxera, so we've done a lot of replanting. And I mean, I've only been with the company for a month now,
mm-hmm.
but it's been really spent in replanting varietals that are really good for that particular soil. We have Cabernet, older vine Cabernet, which is just remarkable. The stuff I'm tasting in barrel right now that's from 2007 just knocked me over. We've got, you know, I've always been convinced, and we've had this conversation before, that Merlot is a cool climate grape. This is a warmer area. It gets brutally cold at night. And
I was going to say, it does cool down at night. That has to help.
Yeah, and in fact, even I think it cools down probably more so than just about any other region of Paso.
Mm-hmm.
There's a gap just around San Miguel where you get a pretty straight shot from the ocean. And the Merlot is just, it's deep, it's black cherry. We've got Sauvignon Blanc, which I, a month ago you couldn't have convinced me could have done any wonderful stuff up there, but I've got stuff that finished fermentation that's in the barrel right now. No malolactic. I picked it at a really low sugar, slow 1 month, one sugar point per day fermentation, and the stuff has all the beautiful grass and gooseberry you expect from a cool climate, Sauvignon Blanc. So I'm totally jazzed.
Well, you know, Paso Robles has certainly gotten its due in recent years. You know, people have awakened to the fact that there are good wineries there that are making good wines. And, you know, everybody always gets compared to Napa. And, you know, Paso has become famous for its Syrah, famous for its Zinfandel, and maybe less so for its Cabernet Sauvignon. But I would maintain, and, you know, I'm good friends with Gary Eberle,
who's the godfather.
He's been there in Paso for a long, long time. And he's always maintained that that he thinks that Paso Cabernet, if it's done right, can hold its own with Napa Cabernet. And I was in Paso to judge at this Vintner's cook-off that they had a month or so ago, and went to Gary's for dinner one night, and he pulled out a 1983 Eberle Cabernet. The wine was beautiful.
Yep.
Beautiful. And so these wines are good. They can age, and the sort of conventional wisdom would be, oh, it's very hot in Paso, so you're going to make, you know, kind of jammy wines with high pHs, and they're not going to age very well. You know, the good wines will age well.
You know, and that's the nature of obviously what's going on has been in the wine industry, riper sugars, riper flavors. And my contention, and I think pretty much everyone's contention now, is that wines that are 16-17% alcohol tend to fall apart a lot quicker. I think there's a solvent property of the alcohol, and you don't have the sugar of a port to be able to sustain any type of ageability. I would say next time you get up to Paso Robles, if you can talk Uncle Ebbs, we call him, Gary Eberle, into breaking out one of his 77 or 79, you'd just be floored. I mean, they're still young, they're fantastic, they're full of tannin structure, and it's really, you know, it's how you farm the fruit, obviously, what making sure you have the right vine for the right little plot of land you're planted on. But, you know, it goes back to, do you make wines to be drunk young and are going to be great now and are going to fall apart in 2 or 3 years? Or do you make wines that may be pretty undrinkable for the first couple of years? And I remember all those old 70s and 80, early 80s Paso cabs, and some of them were so austere and astringent, they're really tough to get your arms around, and just stunning wines.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think one of your trademarks at Hahn was the fact that your wines were well-balanced, and they didn't have the jammy characteristics. Now, you weren't shy about the alcohol. You got your alcohols up around 14.5%.
Sure.
I don't see anything wrong with that, you know. But there are people who push it to over 15 and 16, and the wines almost taste sweet, even though, in theory, they're Cabernets or they're Syrahs, and they're supposed to be they're supposed to be dry wines. So do you see you changing your style at all at this new winery, or are you going to kind of just keep on doing what you've been doing for all these years now at Hahn?
No, I'm in fact, we had this conversation. Fortunately, Ken and Nigel really like the style of wine in the Hahn and the Eberle. And so I'm going to be able to maintain that particular style. In fact, like I said, I just picked Sauvignon Blanc a month before everyone else was picking grapes, just because I knew that's where we needed to go. And you can get big ripe flavors if you know how to control your vineyards correctly. We got a guy by the name of Tony Dominguez who farms for Triana, who's also doing our farming, also our vineyard management, and he's an exceptional grower, and we have these conversations, and it's not about the tiny little crop that you need to do on your vine. It's about a well-balanced vine, not allowing too much sun to get in there, and letting the flavors develop slowly, but, put the water on the vines, keep them happy, healthy, and you end up, we've got Cabernet coming off the vine this Sunday at probably around maybe 24 and a half bricks, which is
13.5,
unheard of in Paso.
Yeah,
now,
14% alcohol.
But we got the flavors, you know, and 14. Well, if it were up to me, I'd love to be making 12.5-13% alcohol wines. But you know, a lot of that, the big alcohol gives a perception of sweetness. And when you're talking, there's some wines out here that are over 17% alcohol, but those are the wines that get these monster scores from some of the big magazines.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
Not me, but
no, I know.
Although occasionally I will like one of the big alcohol wines, and I'll give you an example of one, and that's Schaefer Hillside Select.
Oh, yeah.
It's a wonderful wine, and it's in balance, but the alcohols are up there. But it's a unique situation. It's like I use Lewin Estate as an example for Chardonnay in Western Australia.
Mm-hmm.
They make one of the world's great Chardonnays, and if you tasted it blind, you could swear it's a Chassagne or a Pollini Monrachet. I mean, it's just an incredible wine. I don't know if you've ever had it.
I have had it.
And you know, and everyone around them tries to make the same wine, and nobody can do it. They just have this very special plot of land that allows them to have the structure and the acidity, even though they do, you know, 100% malolactic and new oak barrels every year and all that kind of stuff that would kill a more flabby Chardonnay grape. And theirs just sings.
There is a secret to how you farm the grapes. And obviously terroir is huge. You know, what soil, this little tiny three-acre plot may just have enough wind come through where it's located next to the hill that it changes the whole character of the wine. But it really comes down to the farming of the grape. And I'm convinced, look, if you can find a plot of land, you can grow just about anything if you know how to farm it correctly. And that's really the secret.
How much time do you spend in the vineyards?
Well, I get to spend virtually all of my time now because the winery is located in the middle of the vineyard. We're just off to the side.
Oh, okay. So you have a good view.
I've got to get myself familiar with the grapes and fast, and so I spend as much time as I can out in the
vineyard. Okay, you haven't been there long. I think you started in September.
Yep, 1 month.
At this early stage, what do you see potentially as your benchmark wine somewhere down the road?
You know, I think Petite Syrah. We've got new Petite that's coming online next year. I think it's perfect. You know, I've got Alicante Boucher. Left me scratching my head, and the more I think about it, the more excited I get about
that coming online. There's no huge market for those wines.
Well, you know, but you use it as a blender. Not too long ago, Vogel first, you know, when they had their Petite Syrah, no one knew anything about Petite Syrah except for a few great wine writers, and that was it.
And it is gaining in popularity, and the style of Petite Syrah has changed. They used to make for wines that had very aggressive tannins that would just sort of color your teeth, and
grow hair on your teeth,
grow hair on your chest, and all that kind of stuff.
Well, I've got the Merlot. I've got this old vine Merlot block right now that is under contract to another winery. And I get that back here in a couple of years and get to squeeze a few tons off of there every year.
Okay, you say old vine, how many years?
I think it's got to be about 25, 30 years.
Okay.
We've got some exceptional Cabernet. It's all done in an old bilateral system. It's just, you know, you see the vines hanging out. They're not up on wires. But it really just produces, you know, I had to go through before I lent my name to this place, before I decided to commit. I went through and tasted every barrel and talked to all the winemakers who've worked with the fruit. And it's a magical place. It's a lot of hilly stuff there. And it's a really neat corner of San Miguel, and I'm really excited about this. And again, the Sauvignon Blanc, just I'm floored by the quality of that. And
So to get there, you would, for people who know that road north of Paso Robles out on the 101, you would take the San Miguel exit.
That's one way to do it. Or you could head out 46 east to Airport Road,
where
Jay Lohr is. Mm-hmm. And you just keep going past that, and you follow the signs. The winery is still being built right now, and we're going to become bonded in about 2 months. I'm making my wines over with Don Brady over at Robert Hall right now.
Oh, cool.
And
tell Don I said hi. I haven't seen him in a couple of years.
I'll do that. I think he'd appreciate
it. Anyway, it all sounds wonderful, but you also have your own label, Lazare Wines.
I do.
Tell me about that.
Pinot Noir. I do odd years from Bienesito vineyards. I'm doing a Central Coast Pinot, and this year I started doing a Pinot Blanc. I time to bring back Pinot Blanc, and I'm doing it in a non-malolactic, more gentle.
Talk to Tom Stutz about that.
You remember
when he was at Mirasu?
Mm-hmm.
They had they called it white Burgundy. They had a Pinot Blanc,
right.
And then they had a reserve Pinot Blanc.
Yep.
And I swear, you know, the reserve was twice the price of the regular that they called the White Burgundy. Mm-hmm. That was a great wine.
You know,
the less expensive one.
Oh, everything he did. Well, that that just
because you didn't put a lot more wood on it. You know, you call it reserve. Everybody expects a little more oak.
Sure.
And I always preferred the other wine, and it was about 10, 11, 12 bucks. It was pretty cheap. Might have been less expensive than that. You know, it's they haven't made that wine at Mirisu in some years, not since Gallo bought it. But this is a pretty good wine. And Chillon always made a very, very nice Pinot Blanc, but you don't see a lot of it.
You don't. A gentleman by the name of Clay Brock does a label called Trudevant, mm-hmm. and he's now the new winemaker at Wild Horse. He was at
He used to be at Edna Valley.
And Wild Horse is in Templeton, just not too far from where I live. And Leticia does a Pinot Blanc also. And it's a great grape. It goes with virtually everything. And you know, it's the old anything but ABC, anything but Chardonnay. But I think it used to be such a widely planted grape along the lines of Chenin Blanc, and with the advent of Chardonnay, most of it got ripped out in California. And I really do my own label for fun. I do about 300 or 400 cases, but I have done really well. I got some big competition scores with my own Pinot this year, and sold out, and getting ready to change the label. I had the federal government come in and tell me that I was violating a code with my back label, so I had to.
So I'm looking at a picture, but it's the front label.
and
it says Lazar, you know. So.
Yeah, well, it's in anyone who has a bottle. I'll say it's a collector's item now, but apparently I was violating.
What did you do wrong on the back label, Adam? I mean, I should tell everyone you're kind of the Peck's bad boy of winemakers.
There was a reference. I usually ask people. I say, read the back label. Tell me what was the offending statement. And it takes four tries before they get it right. But it was actually there was a little story about a large cat leaping towards a hunter and then falling on its back only a few feet away, and the hunter turned it over and realized that the cat was drunk, intoxicated. And of course, that little comment about being drunk is actually you're not allowed to put any references to intoxication on any alcoholic beverage, anything that's controlled by the Trade and Taxation Bureau, the old ATF. And that little flipped my mind when I was putting the back label together. So I pulled it off the market dutifully, and we've got a new, if I'm going to ask people to spend $50 bucks a bottle on them, I'm going to be a more serious label.
Felicia, my ever vigilant assistant pulls out this quote from Wine Spies, where you said, "Damn, I knew I was in trouble."
Uh oh.
The big cat's face appeared through the mist, and blah 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 blah. And you just kind of, okay. So you got in trouble with the feds, and you had to change your back label. Was that expensive?
Well, it's expensive to get a good label designer is not cheap. My accountant has assured me that I've lost money every year that I've made my own wine, and I just do it for fun. It's making a half a ton or a ton of Pinot Noir is infinitely harder than doing 200 tons of Cabernet in a tank. I mean, it's the scale is so much different, and when things go wrong. In a half ton of grapes, it happens overnight. It takes a long time for something to go bad, and you can usually catch something, with a larger quantity of grapes.
I should tell everyone the Lazar Pinot is very, very good, even though you can't find it anywhere because he doesn't make enough of it. Anyway, Adam, it's been fun. It's always fun. Good luck in this new venture. We're out of time here. We're gonna have to split.
But, Gosh, thanks, Robert. I appreciate you having me on the show.
I do, and I haven't heard back from you on the Monterey and San Diego competition, so I hope to hear soon.
Because I'm confirming.
I've already got you penciled in, man.
Excellent.
You know, we can't do it without you. Anyway.
I'll bring my sunglasses.
So good luck, and I know you're in the middle of harvest, and thank you for taking this time to be with me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks, Robert.
That's all we have time for this week. This is Robert Whitley for Whitley on Wine, saying until next week, ciao.